Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the GeoMob Podcast. Today, I am pleased to have as my guest, Luis de Souza, who spoke at the recent GeoMob Lisbon back in March, I believe it was. I was not able to attend, but I heard from multiple sources that his talk was very interesting, and indeed, Luis, you won the best speaker prize, so congratulations on that. Our topic today is discrete global grid systems, which is a very interesting technology that some have heralded, and actually in your talk you mentioned as the future of GIS. So we're going to dig into that and understand exactly what is a discrete global grid system, why is it the future of GIS, what discrete global grid systems are there, what does it mean, what do developers need to know about this technology. So let's start, Luis, maybe you can introduce yourself a bit, explain your background and what you do in geospatial.
All right. Well, Ed, first of all, I'm very glad to be here with the podcast. I'm an occasional listener to the podcast, so it will be interesting to hear myself one day. So I am currently an assistant professor here at the University of Lisbon. And my career, even though I am originally a computer scientist, my career has been built on GIS now for over 20 years. And from the very beginning, related with these topics of the partition of the globe, of the Earth, and especially with hexagons. And that's how I've come to this particular topic of DGGS. Besides that, I'm also involved in a number of initiatives around the semantic web. That's probably a topic for another time. But I do a great deal of work with both the OGC and the W3C on specifying the standards and recommendations for the semantic web. But I guess here today we want to talk about discrete global grid systems.
Interesting stuff. So let's dive right in. What is a discrete global grid system?
Oh, wow. I didn't prepare an answer to that, but it's a mechanism that intends to divide the surface of the Earth with some kind of regularity. The main problem that these systems tried to solve was the creation of sampling networks. So this dates back to the late 80s, early 90s, when in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency tried to develop a nationwide environmental monitoring network. And with traditional mapping methods, this was very hard to do. So
latitude and just using a checkerboard of
the problem with longitude and latitude is that it doesn't yield you a regular partition of the spherical space. So as you go from south to the north, the distance between each meridian is narrower and narrower, to the point where you don't have any distance at all at the pole. And right. The same as you go from to the South Pole, of course, from to the south, right? So, and that kind of approach doesn't yield a regular network, and it's not usable. So just...
regular, you mean where each unit is of the same size? I mean, I guess that's kind of a geometric term.
Yeah, you can either think of as cells that subdivide the space, or as points, for instance, where you observe certain phenomena. You want those points to be somewhat equidistant, and using those traditional methods, you just can't do it right.
The hexagon.
Well, the beloved hexagon comes at a later, it's a later step. But what our listeners should understand is that you cannot really divide correctly a spherical surface with squares or with any kind of rectangular area. So okay. the only regular or quasi-regular shapes that can subdivide a spherical surface are either the triangle or the hexagon. And then you have some fine tuning to do around that, but in a nutshell, that's the way to do it.
G is an attempt to create some sort of a reference system that we can use to refer to these.
Yeah, so you have this. Let's try to unpack these four words. So it's twist your tongue, DGGS. So discrete because you're subdividing the space that is continuous. Global because you are applying it to the whole world. Grid because it yields this network or this array of similar or very similar zones, and then system. And system is probably the most important word in this concept, because it's not only about subdividing, but also having the mechanisms to continue subdivide. So imagine that you get at a certain level of refinement, you have a very large hexagon or triangle, and you have a method to subdivide those zones into smaller zones. Let's say a bigger hexagon in smaller hexagons, and then even smaller hexagons, etc. So that's why it's a system.
The late 80s or whatever. So why is it not solved? What's the current state of play?
Well, we could tell the whole story. So so initially, the first hurdles that those folks from in the Environmental Protection Agency and then in partnership with Oregon University in the U.S., the first problem they had is that they didn't have an appropriate map projection to do this. They contacted John Snyder, who was the greatest or one of the greatest cartographers of the 20th century, who developed a map projection specifically for this purpose. And from then on, the works went on to software development. And late 90s, someone that becomes a very important person in this field, Kevin Saar, started developing a software library to apply and to provide methods to work with these kind of systems to programmers. And then in the 2000s, we had the first attempts at commercial software, especially a software called Pixis that I understand some people know it. And it was Pixis was a company founded in Canada by Perry Peterson. And this company didn't necessarily succeed. Things started really to change in 2015 when Uber published H3, which is another...
By far the most widely known of these discrete global grid systems, is that right?
Yeah, indeed. It's the let's say when it was published, it was the one that provided more tools and easier to use tools to programmers and also data scientists, and data scientists are a big piece of this puzzle. Now, to your question, why isn't it solved? It's not that it isn't solved. It's more that this is something. It's something new that is being developed. So you cannot really build this on the traditional cartography system. So you cannot easily build something like this on the software that you are used to use.
So it's the future of GIS? I mean, is this...
That's one of the reasons. So a discrete global grid system is in itself a coordinate system or a reference system, right? So this means that in the future, software will evolve into a state where instead of using the traditional reference systems that we know with, let's say, a geodetic datum and then a map projection, it will evolve, or I hope it will evolve, into a system where you just have your geodetic datum and then you define a discrete global grid system on that datum.
Well, can you give us some example use cases and like who should be using something like this and why?
Okay, so the use cases are very important. So imagine you are a cartographer, or you are licensing home development, water abstraction at the city council, right? For you, if you're working at the scope of a city council, traditional cartography is just what you need, right? You don't need to worry with anything else. You're working at a relatively small scale. You don't need to think beyond that. When we get to the scope of a large country, let's say like the United States, or even a country like Argentina, or if you're working at the continental scale, these traditional mapping methods, they start to impose relevant burdens on you, and especially with the distortions that map projections.
The north-south issue. Okay.
So once you're working, let's say, at the scope of a large country, the scope of a continent, or at the global scale, map methods, the traditional mapping methods, they have a huge penalty, right? And you can see this almost daily, for instance, when you see maps of in topics related to climate change, for instance, right? You see maps, Google maps of that every time. And every time I see one of those maps, I almost cry, because you see things such as the vector projection. You see projections that don't represent correctly the poles where a lot of this climate stuff happens and is important, right? And this is not only with the maps, it's also a problem for the data scientists, the climate scientists, the earth scientists that are working on this kind of big issues, global issues, and they are doing this with traditional mapping methods. So my ambition is that, I don't know, 5-10 years from now, those folks will be working with discrete global grid systems, running their models on these systems, and presenting us data that was produced on that kind of framework.
Let me ask, why don't we just use H3, right? It's an open source technology. Why is that not the standard, or are people using H3, or do we need to go beyond H3? Are there problems with H3? What are we?
Right. Okay, so that's a good. Let's put it down to the practical aspects first. So H3 it was really a milestone, a turning point for this field. It brought attention to something that was really a fringe topic. And I'm very happy for that, and thankful for Uber, not only to do it, but to make it an open source project. That was also very important. And it's a major element in the success of H3 is it being open source. However, the thing with H3 is that it used a very old map projection in its methodology. And the end result of this is that these zones that are cells that this H3 system produces are not the same size, so they are not equal area. So that has to do with a particular problem that Uber was trying to assess, and related to routing and billing, and it was useful for their use case, but let's say for the earth sciences, this kind of partitioning is not as interesting. You can still use it. I know that there are people doing, for instance, flood simulation on H3 and other kind of modeling on H3, but it's just not the kind of perfect or quasi-regular partitioning of space that those folks in the early 90s in EPA and the University of Oregon were ambitioning.
H3, right? It's hexagons, except for there are like one or two pentagons somewhere in the middle of the ocean and things like that.
Yeah. So exactly. So if you're using hexagons, and irrespective of the refinement level, whether you're working with very large hexagons or very small, you will have always 12 pentagons there around somewhere, right?
All right.
And this have to do So if I can track back a little bit, so in traditional cartography, what you the projections you use are usually based on a cylinder or a cone that intersects intersects the spherical surface, and these systems they are developed on projections that are based on Platonic solids. And the most popular and most useful of the solids is the icosahedron, which is a solid with 20 triangular faces. And in the edges of these faces, you end up with these pentagons that you have to position somewhere on the Earth. And there comes that need for the pentagons. And that's why it's not a perfect or a regular partition of the space, but it's a quasi-regular partition of space.
This right now is just full of soccer balls and orange peels, and you're kind of sitting there endlessly trying to like shift around the soccer ball and things like that.
None of that. I also invest a bit of my time on that, but at this moment, I think the most important is the second element of the answer to your initial question: why H3 just didn't took over the world, is that even though this library offers you all these tools and these basic instruments to work with HGS, it doesn't offer you the steps then to, on the one hand, to do spatial analysis, and on beyond that, to provide you some kind of cartography mechanisms. So it's like let's imagine that we have the open source stack. Let's start. We would have QGIS. We have the spatial analysis with modules such as Sextante, etc. And then underneath that, you have Goodall and Proj. And in DGGS, it's like we only have Proj, but not even everything. You only have half of Proj. So you have to build the remainder of the software stack to reach completely to the data scientists, to the earth scientists, and then to the end users, to the stakeholders that just want or just need to take decisions upon the data that they see or they can assess.
And you and others, this is the project that you're kind of...
This is kind of the project, like this, okay. this kind of elusive and ambitious goal of building up from this library, such as H3, such as the DigiGrid library that came out of this work at Oregon University, and to go beyond that to something that other people can use beyond the programmers like myself.
The OGC, it's an attempt to define kind of a new standard or a series of different standards for different use cases?
So 2 points to develop there. So the OGC has done some very important work. So in 2017, the OGC published the first standard on discrete COBOL grid systems that they called it a meta standard. So it was more like, okay, let's settle down what we talk about, right? It was more on the abstraction. And earlier this year, the OGC published a second standard with this, which defines an API that determines how you may access a service that provides data on a DGGS. So it creates a number of methods to, for instance, identify which exact system I'm using, how do I query data, how do I get data for a zone of the planet, etc. And the OGC itself doesn't develop code, it just sets the standards, and we have at present a number of institutions that are somehow developing code to meet those specifications of the OGC. So what you called the project, and I think that's really a good name because it's mostly an idea of mine, is that eventually, by having a number of important players working together around the common open source project, this you will have synergies that will accelerate the development of this full software, GIS software stack on DGGS.
Optier, I mean, you are an academic, and you've mentioned that there are some other universities and things involved, but is this also commercial participants here?
Yeah. So luckily, the let's say, the landscape is quite diverse. And I don't know everyone, especially, for instance, in China, there is a good deal of people working on this, especially in the universities. I'm not necessarily in contact with them, but I am aware of their work. But I would say the important players are those that I'm in contact with. So we have, first of all, the SRA Corporation in Quebec, Canada, and the Pangea community, which I think they are international, and those have been the driving forces behind the OGC standards work. And they have been, and they continue to be. So besides them, and especially the ESRA Corporation has been developing quite a good deal of software and making that software open source. I can go into those details later. But besides them, so there's also the University of Tartu in Estonia, The University of Calgary in Canada, that has now well over a decade been contributing in this field. There's the OpenGeo Hub Foundation in the Netherlands, Max Planck Institute. There's a startup called GeoInsight. They have people here, both in Portugal, also in Germany, that have been trying to develop AI models on DGGS. And these are the folks that I've been in contact more regularly, and that I try to rally around this common goal of developing a DGGS stack, open source, that can be really the turning point towards the future of GIS.
What's the current status? I mean,
the current status, we talk a lot for now, and try to develop a common understanding. And in terms of software, I think for the time being, the most important development is a library called DGGAL that has been developed by ESRA Corporation. And DGGAL, so as the name is inspired on GDAL, or GDAL, as people say in Europe, and tries to provide some of the tools that GDAL provides, but for the discrete global grid systems.
The hoped for end output, is that the same way that currently, you know, in every GIS tool, you know, I'm just kind of working with longitude, latitude. In the future, I'll be able to work with a grid system.
Exactly.
Without having to, it'll just kind of work.
So let's try to put this in terms. So if you want to locate a position on Earth, a position, an area, instead of working with latitude, longitude, you would work with an identifier that identifies, sorry for the, how do you call this? I don't know, sorry about that intermission. So let me track back and then you can cut this out dead. So instead of locating a position or identifying an area on the surface of the Earth with latitude, longitude, you use an identifier that points to a particular cell in a discrete global grid system.
Large, or could be very small, depending on the
So let's imagine that if your identifier has, let's say, 4 digits, it identifies a very large area. If it has 8 digits, 10 digits, it identifies a smaller and smaller area.
Got it. Do you desire more people to get involved? What message would you like to leave the GeoMob community with? Is there something that people can see and play with? Or provide feedback on?
So there are three, let's say, not three, there are two important things. First of all, If you see yourself as a user of these critical grid systems, if you want to do some kind of earth modeling, if you have data at a global scale that you want to store, to serve, to work with, then the way to start is to use one of the existing libraries. Okay. Among those libraries, I would say there are three important ones. We talked already about them, but let me just refresh. So we have DGGrid. That's the old one, the granddaddy of all this. Has a lot of functions and provides you quasi-regular grid systems. And DGGrid has wrappers both for Julia, for Python, and for R. So I think for a data scientist, this is an interesting place to start.
Okay.
Then we have Uber's H3, right? And H3 has evolved also to become something relatively simple to use for a data scientist, someone that knows how to do a little program in Python. So I think in Python or in R, H3 is also quite an approachable library. And now recently we have DGGAL. And DGGAL, okay, it's not yet at the same state of development, but I think, let's say, from a year from now, DGGAL will also be an interesting library to use. And then providing you, let's say, the functionality that goes a bit beyond, more towards data storage and data provision. So those are the three vectors that I would say you could follow upon if you see yourself as a user of this critical grid system. Instead, if you see yourself as a developer, let's say you have ideas on how to implement a discrete global grid system, you have ideas how to use a discrete global grid system to get to some kind of portrayal software to do spatial analysis on discrete global grid systems, then join us. Then come to GitHub and find the GeoPlagmata project, or get in contact with me and just start networking with this landscape of institutions that are working on DGGS and try to identify the synergies that will suit your development.
I encourage everyone to check those libraries out and to get involved. You know what I like most about this, Luis, is for years now in the GeoMap community and the geospatial community in general online, we've been very divided on this whole argument of whether it's latitude, longitude, or longitude, latitude. And finally, we have people who are moving beyond this, right?
Yeah,
are working to solve the problem instead of just arguing.
But,
so.
But let me say it's latitude, longitude. Okay.
You know what, Luis? I actually agree with you. You are right. It is latitude, longitude.
But and there is actually a reason for that, is that back in the day, folks really had a hard time determining longitude. So most of the time, they only knew latitude. So that's why they wrote it first.
Yes, but obviously the counter argument, of course, in all of geometry is this x and y, not...
Yeah, but this is not geometry. This
okay.
is
all right. Let's stop, Luis, because you know we're gonna have to settle that one over a beer at a future GMO.
Yeah, indeed. So, indeed. No point in getting religious about this stuff.
So, no, but in all seriousness, I do encourage all listeners to give that a try, check it out, and I've played with H3 a little bit. And it is very interesting, and this problem does come up quite a bit, that you have people who are working on the problem with all other references to location that we have, you know, especially the human derived ones, the political ones, like be it a postcode or a state or a province or whatever. Of course, exactly as you say, they are all of different sizes, and so it makes true comparison difficult. And then people always, in my business, customers sometimes ask, how can I group my data? And so we do provide H3 references as a tool for that. But it's great to hear that people are working hard on kind of better tools, open source tools that can take it to becoming a true standard. So congratulations to you and to all of your collaborators. Okay, as we wrap up, Luis, any final messages for the GeoMap community? And then, of course, you should also tell us how people can get in touch with you. What is the best way for them to take up contact with you?
Yeah, okay. So final message. I think we can come back here to what is it. Is this the future of GIS, right? Well, I cannot tell the future, but I surely hope it is. And you already referred to this, we deal with things like the latitude and longitude, the number of quirks that we had in geography, cartography. I think DGS is a step that is similar to the step that we had from paper to computers. Okay, when, I don't know, maybe 60s, when we had S3 coming along and the defense, the military starting working with computers to geography. The step up from that traditional cartography to DGS is a similar kind of step. It will take time, and there will be ups and downs. But I think it's the same kind of evolution. And this also doesn't mean that we'll stop using maps, like printed maps, and also that we stop using traditional cartography. But we'll have something that goes beyond that, and that is much more accurate and precise for a number of activities that we do today in GIS. And therefore, I recommend everyone to read up, even if you don't intend to work, even if you don't feel the need to work with DGGS, just read about it. Get in touch. There is this old website that Kevin Saar maintains, this grid, globalgrids.org. That's one place to start. Or you try to get in contact with me or some of the other people involved in this kind of project. So if you want to get in touch, if you want to get involved in this particular project around software, so you go to GitHub and search for this project, Geoplegmata. So that means Earth Grids in Greek. Or you can try to send me an email, and maybe we'll leave that in the description of the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. So that people can check it out.
That would be about it.
I really appreciate you speaking in Lisbon and taking the time to come here on the show. And I agree. People, this is something coming, not just coming, but it's already here. So people should check it out and start playing with it. So thanks very much, Luis.
Thank you, Ed. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.